discerninghearts.com, and Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with the Pope Paul VI Institute, presents Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. Dr. Hilgers, after being deeply touched by the teachings of Pope Paul VI's encyclical Humanae Vitae, founded the Pope Paul VI Institute for the Study of Human Reproduction in Omaha, Nebraska. Dr. Hilgers, along with his co-workers, developed the Creighton Model Fertility Care System. He would go on to discover NAPRO technology. In 1994, Pope John Paul II appointed him to full membership in the Pontifical Academy for Life. And with his wife Susan, Dr. Hilgers serves on the Pontifical Council for the Family. Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Hilgers. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Welcome, Dr. Hilgers.
Thanks, Chris. It's great to be here.
There's no area where misinformation is more prevalent than in dealing with teens and the topic of birth control or the birth control pill. In the 1960s, it was about women's liberation. And there was a presumption that you were a mature woman wanting to make your own decisions. And so you wanted to control, regulate your own body.
Mm-hmm.
How have we become a nation where this has slipped down into teen years when we are giving this birth control, contraception, abortions to children who are not even mature enough to drive a car, to vote?
Well, that's a really good question, and it's not always easy to answer that. There was a huge flaw in the whole premise that a lot of this was argued upon, the premise being sexual freedom, women's liberation.
Mm-hmm.
I always used to say you can't be sexually free until you can say both yes and no. I mean, after all, if you can't ever say no and you can only say yes, how is that being free?
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're on the birth control pill or you're taking some contraceptive or you're being pushed to an abortion clinic where your only answer is, yes, I have to do this, I have to do this, I have to do this, and there's no opportunity or no freedom certainly to say no, then it's really a flaw in the very matrix of how that has been put together culturally and in our social framework. That idea, of course, on the surface, it always sounds great whenever you mention liberation or freedom or whatever. With regard to sexual freedom, what we've really developed is a sort of a form of sexual license. And it's not freeing at all because it's just given people permission to do one thing only. And it's been very harmful as a result of that. And when regard comes down to teenagers, there's the element of Planned Parenthood who continues to harp on the notion that they're going to have sex anyway, so make sure and get them their birth control pill. How many times have you read in the newspaper that somebody will say, maybe in a legislative discussion or something, and they're talking about, well, the number of out-of-wedlock births is increasing, and Planned Parenthood gets in there and says, well, we just need more contraception.
Mm.
We just need more dollars so we can fund our contraception programs. And, of course, on the surface, everybody seems to somehow buy into that argument. And yet, it is the very mere fact of contraception that has continued to increase the out-of-wedlock pregnancy rates.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't get the connection. People seem to think that when you're talking about contraception for a population of people, that means they're always going to use that contraceptive. But the reality is, they sometimes use it, and they sometimes don't. But what they always do is become sexually promiscuous, almost universally. So when they're not being on the contraceptive whatever, they get pregnant. And so the pregnancy rate keeps going up and up and up, and it has been an utter failure. So the next time people hear Planned Parenthood crying for more money mm-hmm. on all of this, they should say, oh, wait a minute, you give us the evidence that this is actually working. But then you got to go back over 40 years to see the whole thrust of it. You can't go back a year or two because sometimes there are little ups and downs in the curve. But the major curve is over 45 years, and the number of out-of-wedlock pregnancies is sevenfold times what it was in the early 1960s, for example. So they haven't developed sexual freedom. They've developed sexual license. Now, on top of that, with the teenagers, sometimes this hasn't always gone over very well with the mothers or the fathers. And so the doctors, and I'll maybe let you in on a little secret, not that I am part of this. I just happen to know that this is what happens. A doctor will say to a young girl, say she's 15 or 16 years of age, comes into the doctor. She has menstrual cramps. Her mother wants to know, is there something we can do about this? The doctor says, oh, yeah, we can give her birth control pills. Oh, good. Well, put her on birth control pills. And what'll happen? Well, she won't have those menstrual cramps anymore. And then in the back of his mind, he doesn't say this up front, but in the back of his mind, he'll say, and she won't get pregnant. Now, how do I know that's in the back of his mind? Because that's what they tell their colleagues. Hey, you know, I saw this girl today and got her on birth control pills, and she's not going to get pregnant now. And he, by that time, he's forgotten the menstrual cramps and everything else. So if you've got a young girl who's got irregular cycles, you've got a young girl who has severe menstrual cramps, you have a young girl who's got some unusual bleeding, all of which are quite common in that age group because their whole system is maturing. It takes about 6 years from the onset of menstruation, the first menstruation, to the maturity of the reproductive system. So a lot of that's happening that's actually quite normal, and they just need to be reaffirmed about that. So they get them put on birth control pills, but in the back of their mind, it's for contraception. So we see this because sometimes the mothers then bring them to us because they don't want them on birth control pills. This isn't anything else that we can do. So we have a we followed a group of young girls, average age 17 now, who were put on the birth control pill specifically because of so-called severe menstrual cramps. And we got them off the birth control pill. We have 35 or 40 patients in this group now. And we laparoscoped them. We put a little scope in to take a look at the uterus, tubes, and ovaries. And 100%, every one of these young girls had endometriosis.
Wow.
Now, endometriosis is harmful to future fertility. It can cause miscarriages. And, of course, it causes severe menstrual cramps. So if we do an operation, laser out the endometriosis, for the most part, it takes care of all the pain and menstrual cramps that they have. And once they stop the birth control pill, it all comes back again because it doesn't treat anything. The big mirage out there is that somehow the birth control pill treats these diseases, but it doesn't. It's nothing but a Band-Aid. It's a symptomatic approach completely, and it doesn't get to the root causes. And so what's happening, I think at least, with these young girls is their real health care is being neglected, and they're being placed in a position at a later time in their life to be infertile, to have maybe multiple miscarriages or some other problem with regard to their fertility.
It's so ironic when you think about it, when we put our kids on birth control and we're telling them, okay, go lose control. To a teenage mind, isn't that what you're saying?
Well, I think exactly that's what you're saying. No matter what you tell them, they understand what this birth control pill is for. And that's, I've never heard it said quite like that, but it's very well put.
The damage that's done to them as well, potentially. You talked in previous segments about how truly ineffectual the condom is. And yet that is something that there are schools, public schools now, that have condom dispensers in the bathrooms. I mean, what are we doing?
Well, as a society, we have capitulated to all of the pretty superficial arguments that are put forward to support condoms in the bathrooms or whatever, any type of contraception that is promoted in the public school system or other schools for that matter, I suppose. Again, we're just somehow we're blinded by what this really does. And we have to get, we got to take the blinders off because this is harmful to real people. And especially these young girls, I mean, it can be really devastating to them at a later age, which I see them at a later time when they have the infertility problems and they've got 10 years of being on birth control pills and it never solved anything. Now we have to restart everything all over again, but sometimes their reproductive system's been damaged, I think, by the long-term application of.
It demands a lot of parents to spend time with teenagers or even in those early junior high years and probably even before that, discussing human sexuality with their children. And as they mature, the discussion needs to mature and deepen. And that whole idea of the dignity of the human person and what it is, as John Paul that talked about the theology of the body, of what it is to be female and what it is to be male. But that takes a lot of effort to incorporate that. And sometimes it's so much easier when you have soccer games over here and you have choir over here and you have this over here, plus you have your work schedule. When you don't have that time, but you want to make sure they're not going to get in trouble, it's easier to give them a pill.
Yeah. One of the things that's interesting in a family that uses a natural method of family planning is that some discussion of these sorts of things goes on within the family, between the parents and stuff, and it's just everyday talk. It's not like we're going to go into this little room, we'll talk about it and whisper so the children don't hear us. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just there. It's, you know, you don't think anything of it, but it makes a big impact on the children. And so they learn chastity by watching and observing and being a part of this role model. In our own family, we've done a couple of things that might be sort of unique. We, with all of our five children, we've used the 10th birthday on the Feast of the Annunciation, because we want to know for them, we want to get the idea or discuss with them, what relevance does the Feast of the Annunciation have with the Feast of Christmas? And if nobody's ever thought about it, it's exactly 9 months later. The Feast of the Annunciation is the Feast of the Conception of Christ. So we can talk, and I don't talk about the biology so much as I talk about something else, and that's what we call values. And I just talked to them about values, and I said, do you know what a value is? What are the values we talk about? And they have trouble kind of sorting all that. And I says, well, values are things that are just really important to you. And these are things that you grow and develop with over a lifetime. Maintaining yourself in a sexually intact fashion and not being used and not being seduced and not being pulled in by different things that seem like they're good on the surface, or at least they have a strong pull to them, is part of the value that you see in yourself and in others. And so we don't want you to take advantage of anybody else. We don't want anybody taking advantage of you. And then later, and when they turn around 15 or 16 years of age, we have another little ceremony in the family, and we, not necessarily tied to the Annunciation this time, but we actually have them sign a contract.
Good for you.
And we say, okay, here's what we expect, because it's right when they're starting to learn to drive. Mm-hmm. So this is what we expect with driving. This is what we expect your performance in school is going to be. This is what we expect with regard to drugs. This is what we expect with regard to alcohol and cigarettes. And this is what we expect with regard to sexuality. And we just lay it all out. And then we have a nice, long discussion about it. And then as a father of the family, I pray over them and have the other members of the family sort of lay their hands upon them. Oh, man, this is really cool. Now, I never observed this when I was a child growing up, but it is really neat because they really feel special. And they feel like there's a connection to something that's really real for them to be working forward and towards. And so far, it's worked really well.
It really is living it out. It's role modeling to the extreme.
Yeah.
But to the best extremes, because it's the effort that's put into that. A child who watches natural family planning and can see that in a marriage, a young girl learns to monitor her own body, begins to work with it, doesn't want to alter it, but wants to be able to work with it.
Yeah. No, it's true, and I think that I remember one of our teachers, one of our educators, who's been working 25 years or more with the Creighton model, told us a story about one time about her young daughter who was only like 3 years of age, and her young daughter came in one day real serious and says, "You know, Mommy, I'm not going to ever get pregnant." Well, of course, she didn't know where she was coming from with a comment like that at age three. So she says, "Well, now why do you think that?" She says, "Well, Mommy, I don't have any mucus." And so, but she had observed this and she had seen this. And so that she made these connections. Well, what an opportunity. These are the things that happen within the family, and what an opportunity to just spend a few moments. You rarely have to get into long discussions on this because frankly, they're not interested. They really aren't. I remember having a couple of times with my own children where I thought, oh God, now I got to sit down and really talk about this stuff and makes everybody uncomfortable and all this. And so I started and I get going and they kind of look at me and says, "Well, are you done yet, Dad?" And I said, "Well, what do you think?" He says, "Well, I've heard enough, man. I just want to get out and go play."
Sounds you know? Like my kids.
Yeah, but it was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. I learned a lot from that, and it was pretty neat.
Well, it's learning how to, especially for boys in families, watching the father figure participate in this mutual self-giving to the mother in a caring, because natural family planning isn't just about the actual coming together in the sexual relationship, but it's about all the aspects of just living a chaste life and giving to one another. And that example for children who see that it is a tremendous experience of true family.
Well, again, they see that wholeness, that mm-hmm. whole person that we're talking about and have mentioned many times when we talk about a natural system. And so it's a tremendous role model to them, and they do relate very, very well to it. One other thing about that that's really interesting, I think, is that we talked one other time about the difference between arousal touch and affirming touch.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you're dealing with your children, arousal touch is absolutely 100% not to be done. We know that. We understand that. I mean, there's all sorts of crimes that are part of that, and they're horrible. They're absolutely horrible. But affirming touch, just hugging your child, holding your child's hand, things that they receive the warmth of that touch from their parents, is actually something that I think probably goes on more frequently within a family where a natural method is being used, because they're used to doing this, actually. For example, if they're in a mode where they're using it to avoid pregnancy, then there's a period of time in that cycle every month where they're not going to have genital contact. That doesn't mean they can't have any physical contact, but they don't have intercourse, they don't have genital contact, but they have this arousal touching of hugging and affirming touch that we're talking about, and the children are the beneficiaries of that because they too get the affirming touch. And that's really valuable to them as they're growing up. They develop security. Their own self-esteem is improved. They're being honored by their parents, respected by their parents, and so forth. And all these things are really important in their growth and development into a sexually whole person.
Dr. Helgers, there are so many different chemicals, devices, different things that parents are being encouraged to give to their sons, their daughters to prevent pregnancies, or that are being sold as protective of their sexual behavior. A very confusing one right now that's out there is the HPV vaccination, which is a preventative of cervical cancer. And many parents are struggling with, what do I do with this one? I don't understand this at all.
Yeah, this is the human papillomavirus, which is transmitted sexually, and usually young women are more susceptible to this virus if they have intercourse with somebody who's a carrier. And it is the virus that can lead, doesn't automatically lead, incidentally, to mm-hmm. cervical cancer, but it is the virus when you get cervical cancer that was responsible for it. So they've come up with this vaccine. Now, there's several things that people need to know about it. First of all, it only protects from a medical point of view, from 70% of the different viruses that can actually cause cervical cancer. So there's 30% that it doesn't protect at all. Secondly, it's actually very expensive. It runs about $400 or $500. And thirdly, there's three separate injections that the person who's getting the vaccination needs to have.
Wow.
And I think fourthly, which is a combination of a lot of different things, one is I don't know that we know for certain how long it's going to last. And I don't think we know for certain what the long-term side effects might be. Now, the drug company may say, well, we do know, but it hasn't been out that long, and we're pretty certain we don't know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's some real definite things that we do not know about this. Now, on the one hand, if you just think of it ethically or morally, is there any reason not to get it? Well, or let me put it the other way, maybe it would be a better way to start it. If you were to choose to get it, would you be committing some sort of a moral abnormality or problem? And the issue is probably not. There's other factors that fit into that that decision as to the morality of it. For example, you tell your daughter, you need to get vaccinated because I know you're going to have sex here in the next year or so, and I know I can't stop you, and you're encouraging that sort of activity. Well, that's the reason it's not good for
mm-hmm.
them. Now, the other side of that coin is, what happens if you choose not to get it? Well, there's a lot of things. First of all, the majority, almost majority, not quite, maybe 40% of young women do not involve themselves in sexual activity before marriage.
Mm-hmm.
It'll vary depending on what study you hear. And as I've said before, the real miracle, the real story on all of this with regard to sexuality in teenagers is around that group of people, because our society is so inundated with this sort of genitocentric view of sexuality we talked about before, that it's amazing anybody escapes it. So mm-hmm. the real story is those who don't become genitally active. But if they don't become genitally active, they're not susceptible to the human papillomavirus or to getting cervical cancer. It's an absolute zero. Now, when they get married, they could get married to somebody who had been sexually active before and could be carrying that virus. And that actually could be discussed ahead of time, and presuming that that individual would be honest with her, they should be able to make a decision whether or not they should or should not get vaccinated. If he's never had sexual intercourse before, then he doesn't have to be she doesn't have to be vaccinated even at that time. So, and if he has been sexually active, there's not a real good way, I don't think. I'm not a urologist, so I'm not sure of this, but I don't think there's a real good way to determine if the man has human papillomavirus. But, you know, then it's just a decision of whether you do or don't. But whatever you do, if you do get the vaccination, you're still not fully protected. So that's to me, seems to be a big issue here.
It seems extraordinarily presumptuous then, based on that, for a legislator, mainly a governor, to be specific, for example, the governor of Texas, to mandate that all girls 6th grade and up should have this vaccine.
I think it's an outrage, frankly, and people should rebel against it significantly, because there is a significant group of young women who absolutely 100% do not need this virus. Now, say they use the excuse of, what if she gets raped? Well, look, if we lived our life based on what if we get raped, first of all, we're going to be petrified the rest of our life. Mm-hmm. And secondly, you know, we're not taking contraceptives. We don't get sterilized because we might get raped. I mean, there's a lot of things we don't do.
And it's extraordinarily small percentage.
Well, it's a very, very, very small percentage. And that ultimately is where I'm leading to, because now I absolutely, rape is horrible. I'm not in any way wanting to convey anything other than that. It's just the most horrible thing. And I've seen young women as they get older, and they've either been raped or they've been sexually molested at a younger age, and it's a horrible thing to have had done to them, and it leaves huge psychological scars. So that's another area. In fact, it would be much more important to be able to work with that individual if she got raped with regard to the psychology and the psychological scars and spiritual scars than it is to be vaccinated with an HPV vaccine, to be honest with you. I mean, I just think that that's a superfluous argument. It has no superficial argument. It has really very little basis. But you're going to hear that argument a lot, because it's, whenever you mention rape, it's another one of these emotional issues. But you still have to think it all through. Now, there are people, though, I'm sure, that probably need this vaccine, and from that point of view, it might be at least to some extent good, keeping in mind it's not 100%, and it's never, well, I don't know if it'll ever be 100%, but at least for the time being, it's not 100%, and so it doesn't give 100% protection to this.
Oh, and they've said that before about other chemicals and other vaccines and other shots and pills and everything else. Boy, time has proven those.
And especially with regard to the side effects. And then the question, which I raised earlier, about whether or not they need a booster shot at some later time. I don't think that's been determined yet. And so what happens if you're, I mean, they're doing this at age 12. So, I mean, what if it only lasts 4 years?
Right.
And now they got to get another one at age 16 and then another at 20. And where's the end of this thing? I don't see any huge moral dilemma in having received the vaccination, although I have questions. I don't know exactly how it's been manufactured and so forth, but I don't see any real major problem there. What I do see, however, are real practical problems that are medical issues that I think people need to think through before they take this vaccine, and be realistic with themselves about it, because if you're not going to be sexually active, there's no reason to get it.
The document that so affected your life, Humanae Vitae, that great encyclical of Pope Paul VI, really is a wonderful baseline for parents when dealing with the growth of your children, especially in those teen years. If you could just take time to read that just for a few moments and pray with it, you do not have to be afraid of educating your children in the beauty of the sexuality that God has created them.
You know, sometimes people are more afraid of discussing this because they think they have to get into a big biology lesson. That applies to parents. Unfortunately, it also applies to our priests. They're afraid to talk about some of this because they think they're not adequately prepared on the biological aspects of all of this. But, you know, when you mention Humanae Vitae, the real issue really isn't the biology. And you don't, as a parent even, you don't even have to talk a lot about biology if you're not comfortable with it. What has to be, well, put it another way, there's very few human beings that in the course of human history have not been able to figure out how to have intercourse. Mm-hmm. But there's a ton of human beings who haven't figured out the proper values to where intercourse plays in their life. And the church has the role of teaching the values. The parents have the role of teaching their children those values. And I had said earlier about Humana Vitae that in the first 8 or 10 paragraphs are the major values of it. And if you believe that marriage is something that is exclusive amongst two people, if you believe that it should be fecund, if fertile, meaning fertile, mm-hmm. if you believe that it should that fidelity should be a part of this, and you believe these fundamental principles of a marriage unit, contraception doesn't fit into that, nor does out of wedlock intercourse, premarital sex, those kinds of things. They just don't fit. But it's those values that are communicated in that encyclical letter that had a huge impact on me when I read it. And by the time I got through that, I knew there could be no other answer to some of these questions. And so, they're not complicated. If we just had a priest who once a year or once every couple of years would get up in front of the whole congregation and say, "Look, I'm not gonna mess with any biology today. You don't have to worry about me stumbling over this or stumbling over that. But I do want to tell you something I know something about, and that is these are the moral virtues that Humana Vitae talks about, and you need to think about these, and just lay them out for people." And I tell you, I mean, the encyclical only takes about 20 minutes to read the whole thing from front to front. So that's if you right. want a 6 or 7 minute sermon, you can easily get it out.
A wonderful suggestion that I hope that all priests and deacons take to heart. Humanae Vitae, the cornerstone of the Pope Paul VI Institute. Thank you so much, Dr. Helders, once again for such a wonderful segment. I look forward to next time.
Yeah, well, thanks, Chris. Me too.
You've been listening to Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Helders. To hear and or to download this episode, along with many others, go to discerninghearts.com. To learn more about the work of Dr. Helders and the Pope Paul VI Institute, go to popepaulvi.com. This has been a production of discerninghearts.com, Spirit Catholic Radio, and the Pope Paul VI Institute. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. Join us next time for Your Fertility Care Consult with Dr. Thomas Helders.